Welcome back to the Film Experience. This is your Thanksgiving weekend podcast, although by the time you hear it, you'll be back to your regular life. So sorry, I'm dreading tomorrow. This has been a nice long weekend.
It's been so great. This is Murtada. Hi.
And this is Nathaniel. So what did you see over this weekend, Murtada?
Oh, I saw A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood. I saw Uncut Gems. And on Thanksgiving, I saw Moulin Rouge, Black Swan, Bridget Jones's Diary, and Hustlers. That was an amazing day.
Wow, so you just like laid in bed and watched movies?
Well, yes, Philip was cooking and we had guests and whatever. And those movies play during the day.
Well, I failed for the first time at convincing my friends to go to a movie on Thanksgiving, so I feel like an abject failure. I could not get them to go see A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood, which is what I was really pushing for, and then I switched to Knives Out, thinking maybe they're more in the mood for that. Couldn't convince them.
Oh.
So we ended up staying in and watching screeners. We watched Us and Booksmart.
Oh, those are good movies to watch.
Yes.
With friends at home.
Yes, so Booksmart, still hilarious all these months later.
Hustlers is the only screener that I have watched. Of all the screeners that I got, I think twice, maybe three times since I got it. But
yeah.
It works right, so every time. And you put it in and you're like, I'm just going to watch J-Lo do Criminal. And then 2 hours later, you're just still watching Hustlers.
I have not put that one in yet, but it is on the stack. What movie should we start with today?
Let's start with Mr. Rogers and Tom Hanks, A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood.
Which I loved so much, which is why I'm so sad that I could not convince my friends to go see it.
So tell us why you loved it. You already said you're putting it in your top 10. Spoiler!
I just thought it was such a great angle to look at a figure as iconic as Mr. Rogers, because with people like that, that are why they're iconic is not their personal life at all, or even who they are. It's the effect they have on people.
Yes.
So I was so glad it wasn't a traditional biopic, because from everything I've heard, he's too, it wouldn't make an interesting story. You know, he's a little bit, still a little opaque to us, you know. But I don't think that's what's important about him. So I loved that it took this different angle of, like, looking at his effect on people, because that was his whole, the whole reason he's legendary. And I just found it very, very moving. I mean, complete for even, like, the sappiest of scenes got to me, like that subway scene where people sing A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood to him.
That was such a good scene. I teared up too, even though this was the first time I have ever seen footage of Mr. Rogers. And I know it wasn't Mr. Rogers, it was Tom Hanks, but
right.
Doing Mr. Rogers. But I've never watched the program, I haven't seen the documentary.
Yeah, and I'm not nostalgic about Mr. Rogers. I did not grow up watching that. I don't know why my parents weren't into showing me that. I've seen it a few times when I was a little kid, but it wasn't anything regular for me. So I don't really have any nostalgia for it, but I just found it so, so moving.
I thought Tom Hanks was so sublime, and whenever he was on screen, the movie was so gripping, and it's a complete star turn. And maybe you can tell me if he was doing an imitation or not, but because I don't know Mr. Rogers, but I just thought whatever he was doing was very effective, like just being genial and decent. And, you know, because the reporter character is always trying, like, find the secret behind, or if he's
yeah.
playing a character, and he's just doing it and doing it so well. And he's playing decency, but he's also playing the charisma of a TV star. And it's such mm-hmm. a star turn. It's so well modulated. He's just so great.
Yeah, I loved him in it too. And, Yeah, as far as The Imitation goes, you know, I've noticed people in the comments at the site are like, oh, he looks and sounds nothing like Mr. Rogers. And, you know, I'm going to defer to them to an extent because, as I said, I didn't really watch Mr. Rogers that much growing up, though I have seen episodes and I do know what he looks and sounds like. But to me, what's important about biopic performances is the spirit of the person, the soul of the person, and to some extent with Mr. Rogers, it's the voice, and I did think he sounded like Mr. Rogers. Like, it was the cadences, maybe not the exact vocal tone, but the cadences, like, the word choices, like, I totally bought it. So I was fine with it, but some people seem to think it's a bad imitation. I do not know.
Yeah, I wouldn't know. I thought the performance was fantastic.
Yeah, and it's the spirit of it, and I think he just nailed that. Like this, and I found it so interesting, his performance, the nuance of like somebody who, not that it's all a performance because it's very earnest, but it's somebody who chose to be this very, very specific way. Mm-hmm. So their personality is a performance to the extent of they are willing themselves into being the kind of person that they've chose to be because they think it's the right kind of person to be, which I thought was a beautiful way to approach it.
Yeah, totally right. And you think Heller is 3 for 3, right? Like, Richard Brody in The New Yorker called her a genius. Way to go, Mariel Heller.
Yeah, I think she's one of our best working directors, period. And she keeps, as I said in my little capsule review, she keeps taking these topics and these like concepts that don't seem like they would make like cinema, you know, because they're so internal. And yet she just keeps making great movies.
Yeah. I still think Diary of a Teenage Girl is her best film, but yes, she's definitely a great director. I had sort of had a problem with the other performance. What did you think of Matthew Rhys?
I really like him as an actor, but I can understand, you know, I've heard a couple of people saying, you know, it needed to be maybe more of a star turn. Like he, in terms of carrying a film, he does, I do think of him as more of like a character actor than a star.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I think it works in this context because even though he's the lead, it's about the effect that Mr. Rogers has on people. So you need the star doing the Mr. Rogers performance.
Yeah, I think it needed more pizzazz. He just was so blank the whole time. And it just made all the scenes with him so flat. I didn't think he had any chemistry with his wife at all. And he was just not compelling to watch. Like, he made me not care for the central narrative thrust. Like, because the movie in the end, which is I understand why making that choice. You do it as an episode of Mr. Rogers. You not mm-hmm. you do it as what Mr. Rogers is going to do to help someone else. But I just didn't care about this someone else.
Hmm. So you didn't love the movie then?
I love Tom Hanks.
So you didn't love the movie. No, I get that complaint, but for me, the movie just worked. I do think, like, you know, it is a little tropey, the sort of distant father and all of that. But we have seen it before. But by the same token, there is whole generations of people to whom it's a trope for a reason, you know, that there was whole generations that had this issue with their fathers being distant. So I know why it always comes up in movies, because, you know, it's a gender politics thing, but men were taught to be a certain way, and that is not necessarily a nurturing way for the people who need to be nurtured by them.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, I get why it keeps coming up in movies, but yes, we have seen it many times.
Yeah, I think a big star turn in that role would have made this sort of story we've seen before pop, because you need to give it something. Like, if he had combustive chemistry with the actress playing his wife, if he was, I don't know, doing something more than just being recessive and blank, I think it would have helped the movie so much.
Okay. I will say that I met, this will be an interview later on the site, I did meet the journalist, Tom Juno, who wrote the article that it's, that it's inspired by. And let me tell you, for this isn't always the case with journalism, that man has charisma.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So it was, like, really interesting to talk to him. And but one of the things that was interesting about it is that I thought it was, like, I had read the piece, and I thought it was, like, really, like, a true story, because the piece isn't very personal.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I just assumed it was true. But I guess one of the issues that people have with it is that, what am I trying to say? Edit. is that it's so fictionalized. So it's, you know, they changed the name, which mm-hmm. is good, because, like, none of these things, he was telling me, none of really, yes, he wrote about Mr. Rogers, and yes, he found it very, you know, mm-hmm. a fascinating, reflective thing to interview this person, but he did not have, like, a volatile relationship with his father. You know, there was never fights between them. So it's basically like a made up story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I thought so because of the name change.
Yeah. Anyway, so
they
that.
Were trying to make it more dramatic in the mm-hmm. screenplay. Yeah. I mean, you know, in the end, I didn't love this movie, but any movie that sort of is trying to tell us this beautiful, heartfelt story about how you can find a way to make your life bearable and know how to live. Like, it's definitely worth a watch. Like, I was very moved at the end with Chris Cooper, and this is a spoiler, so if you don't want to know, skip 30 seconds. As he's dying, he says, "It's unfair. I have just learned how to live." And that was a moment that sort of encapsulates the story for me, because this is about Mr. Rogers showing people how to live.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, I'm a huge fan of it. I found it very cathartic, the whole experience. And it's rare, I think, when, even if you love a movie, it's rare that a movie makes you feel like you want to be a better person. You know, they always talk about, like, inspirational movies, but usually that's very sort of surface level, like, mm-hmm. oh, that story is so inspiring. But what does it actually inspire in you, you know, other than sort of awe at the, you know, like, I'm talking about great man cinema, in quotes, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Like, all the biopics, like, people can find these stories, these true stories, you know, about real people inspiring, but I think in a very abstract way. But this felt like a movie people need to actually see. A need to actually think about. I'm a huge fan of it.
And people are seeing it. It did very well over Thanksgiving. So even though your friends didn't want to go see it, a lot of other people wanted to go see it, including us. We went.
Yes. Anyway. So yes, that's a big thumbs up for me and a mild thumbs up from Murtada.
But I am into Tom Hanks camp. Tom Hanks for everything. He's so lovely. Such a great performance. And it's not just the star turn. It's a really heartfelt, beautiful performance, layered with so many. He's doing so much in this film.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the rest of the actors maybe aren't on his level, though, in short.
I think Chris Cooper is pretty good. Not at the Hanks level, but he did what he could with that part.
Mm-hmm. And Knives Out. I don't have a ton to say about this because I don't want to be a curmudgeon. People really, really love this movie, and I'm still trying to wrap my head around why. To me,
maybe
it was
because
of,
you're not into whodunits. Are you into whodunits usually? Like, do you like Agatha Christie?
Not particularly. No, not particularly. Because I always feel like they're cheating. Like, you know, they're always withholding enough information that, you know, it's just a mystery that you can't, you know, piece together yourself, type of thing.
Yeah.
And I, you know, I'm just not that into the genre. It's true, but I also. And this is like a film snob thing. I also thought the movie was really, really ugly, in terms of visually. And which is not a reaction I usually have to movies, because usually I find them at least, you know, usually I don't, if a movie isn't beautiful to look at, I don't really think about its visuals, you know. But when I'm thinking, oh, this is ugly to watch, then there's a problem, you know. Like, I just, like, you know, I don't mean to be offensive, but I don't understand what was going on with the cinematography and other things, because I just thought it was really not pleasant for the eyes.
I didn't have a problem with the cinematography, but I thought the costumes were great. Everybody looked amazing in those costumes. Sweaters and coats, and Lachise was looking so great, and Daniel Craig. So those costumes I liked. Both of those guys' costumes were really
good. Oh, Chris Evans in sweaters, that's a win.
Yes, for sure.
But, yeah, you know, what is Chris Evans not a win in visually?
Yeah, totally. I mean, he didn't have facial hair, so there's a slight minus visually in this film. And I love Toni Collette. How brilliant is Toni Collette doing Goop? So brilliant.
Yeah. It's like a fun, but my thing with it is just like, it's one of these big ensemble movies, as most whodunits are, and I just wanted more time with the people that I found entertaining. Mm-hmm. Like, I thought Jamie Lee Curtis was kind of wasted. I thought what Tony was doing was amazing, but there wasn't enough of her. So it was just kind of like an okay movie. But people are just so enthused about it that I was actually trying to convince my friends to go see it. I'm like, I'm telling you, I'm the only person who doesn't love it, apparently.
Yeah, I also didn't like the fact that, you know, as an immigrant, I don't like people telling me I'm an immigrant all the time. And because basically you're being othered all the time. And I felt this movie was othering its lead character all the time. And it's just not a good, even though it's, like, positive about that othering, but it was just way too much othering.
But don't you think that was what the point of with the other characters were, that they were purposely...
Well, it's othering. The point, but it still doesn't make for a comfortable sit.
Mm, okay.
So there is actually a very good article exactly about that in the New York Times opinion by Monica Castillo. And so everybody should go read that. But it's like a fun movie, but maybe I just didn't have as much fun. Both you and I didn't.
Yeah. But apparently, is my point, don't take our word for this, because most people seem to just think it is so fun. So maybe we weren't in the right mood. I do not know. I saw it at Toronto, and I normally don't see like big star mainstream movies at Toronto because... Unless they have a ton of Oscar buzz, because I think, oh, that'll come out and it'll be in thousands of theaters and, you know, I'd rather see obscure things. But people kept saying at TIFF, like, oh my God, Knives Out is so great. You have to go see it immediately. And so I was like, oh wow, what a surprise, you know, but then I wasn't surprised. Or rather, I was surprised, but I didn't understand why everyone was like forcing me to see this movie.
Well, yeah, I don't think I would force anybody to see it. And people are saying that it's going to get an Oscar nomination for a screenplay. I'm like, that's a long convoluted screenplay. And I know whodunits are all about the last half an hour. You have to re-explain everything. But that felt like 7 hours long, the re-explanation of everything that happened. It plays into that sort of formula. So I'm not dinging it for it. This is, you get what you expect and you get what you should get from this kind of movie, but I just don't think it's best writing of the year candidate.
Mm-hmm. Well, that category is very, I mean, I could theoretically see it happening, but that category is so super stacked and mostly with best picture contenders. So I find that even though I could completely 100% see it getting nominated in an off year for original screenplay, I think that's a tough thing to try to sell this year.
Yeah.
When most of the big Best Picture candidates are original screenplays.
I mean, there is moments of fun. Like, I agree with you that I wanted more of Toni Collette. Whoever is out there, if wants to write a movie about Goop, do it right now before Toni Collette is too old to play Goop, because she would be perfect.
Would be perfect for so many things. I do not understand why some auteur hasn't snatched her up as his chief muse or her chief muse.
Right.
Like, she's so brilliant all the time, and people just are just sleeping on it. I don't get it.
Yeah. And she's so brilliant here. So I was just so in love with her. And then Lakeith and Daniel look great. So hoorays for the costume designer. If I'm at mortadaelfadla@gmail.com, if you want to send me links to all those costumes.
Video of the fitting room.
Yes.
So, tell us what you think about Knives Out. I am actually really curious what Film Experience community thinks of it, because I don't know, was I just in a bad mood? Do I need to give it another chance? I don't know.
I don't think you need to give it another chance. Remember, it's 2 hours and 15 minutes. You don't have time for that.
That's so true. That is so true this time of year. Like, I was, even though I really wanted to see Us and Booksmart again because they came out so long ago, while I was watching them, I was just like, oh, but I need to be doing all this work. I've already seen these. But it was enjoyable to watch them again.
Besides, you can watch Hustlers and maybe the criminal sequence 7 times in 2 hours and 15 minutes. So there's where you should spend your time.
Yeah, I'm having trouble right now because, you know, in the Film Bitch Awards, I have those categories for Diva of the Year and Sex Pot of the Year and Hero and Villain, you know, the character awards.
So J-Lo is going to win all those, right?
Well, but I have this sort of, like, unwritten rule that you can't be nominated in all of those categories, so you have to, like, pick one. But I'm like, does she belong in Diva or Sex Pot, which is most descriptive?
I think you going to have to make an exception this year. You know, rules are meant to be broken, Nathaniel. There comes a time when something comes that is so huge, so monumental, that they break the rules. And I think J-Lo in Hustlers is that time. Break the rules.
Mm-hmm. This time of year, that's all it's pretty much my train of thought on everything is, but what will be nominated for the Film Bitch Awards in this category? I'm constantly thinking about it. And that's why I have to cram more movies into my eyeballs before I make those decisions.
So, listeners, if you want Nathaniel to break the rules for Jennifer Lopez in Hustlers, comment, let us know. She needs to win Sex Pot and Diva and Hero and whatever else she can win. So let us know in the comments. Tell him to break the rules. It's time. The time has come.
She is a rule breaker in that movie.
Absolutely.
So the other movie that opened, sort of, but also streaming, or is it streaming later? I can never keep track of Netflix. Atlantix.
Yeah, it's streaming. It's playing in New York and L.A., and it started streaming on Friday. So, yeah, people can click on it right away.
And it's, I think you can attest to this, it is brilliant.
So brilliant.
It is, for those of you who haven't heard of it, it's from Senegal. It won, I think, the second place in Cannes
second
jury
place,
prize.
Yes, from Matty Diop.
And Matty Diop is a new filmmaker. And she is obviously gifted. Let's just put it that way. It's only the first movie, so we don't know what kind of career she's going to have, but wow.
Yeah, I mean, it's jumping without an ad, audacious filmmaking. It's her first narrative. Like, imagine the leaps she could make with her fifth. Like, it's just, she's so assured, so bold. Like, what I loved really about this movie is that she does these things that you don't think a first-time director would even dare to do. Like, she has, like, several genres in this movie. She starts a story and then completely abandons it 10 minutes into the movie and starts another one. And then you're like, nope, we're now going to be a ghost story half an hour into it. And now ghosts start appearing and supernatural things and mysticism. And you're like, what movie am I watching? It's not the same. And it's just so audacious.
Yeah, no, I was pretty mesmerized by it. I reviewed it out of TIFF, and like Parasite, I think it's really good to go in without knowing much about it. But it's true that it does start in such a way that you think it's going to be one movie, and that movie would be worth seeing, but that's not the movie it turns out to be.
Mm-hmm.
Because the character it starts with is not even the main character.
Not at all.
So, yeah, so you think that it's going to be about him, and then it turns out to be about his girlfriend, sort of, but also about all these other things. So it's really kind of a wild ride. There are jaw-dropping moments, and I was talking to Nick about this the other day. I wish he was on the podcast this morning, because he's also a huge fan of this movie. I think it's his number one of the year or something, or very close to that. And we were, you know, discussing various jaw-dropping moments. And I'm like, could you believe that happened? And, you know, we're not going to do that on the podcast because we don't want to spoil everything. But we were both like, that feeling of anything could happen on screen is so rare in movies. And I always think back to this, like, classic Pauline Kael review of Robert Altman's Nashville.
Mm-hmm.
About that feeling when a filmmaker is performing without a net, as you said, Murtada.
Mm-hmm.
Like, where you're watching something and you just, suddenly it's like inside of you, you have no idea what's coming, and you're just so excited because, like, what am I watching? And I'm gonna go wherever this filmmaker takes me, you know?
Yeah, I want to go with Maddie Diop wherever she goes. Let's go. Make another movie. Make it soon. Or I'm just going to watch Atlantis for the fourth time. I've seen it several times. I love it so much. It's so
cool. You've already seen it more than once.
Yeah, I've seen it at the New York Film Festival at the critics screening. And then Philip and I went to the premiere. So by the time the festival ended, I've already seen it twice. And then I saw it again, because I was interviewing her, because it was a couple of months, and I'm like, you know, I asked for a screener to see it, and I did. I was like, oh, I'm just going to fast forward and look at some scenes that I have some questions about, but then I just watched the whole thing.
Yeah, so for those of you who haven't seen it yet, it is on Netflix, and make sure to check out Murtada's interview with Maddie Diop after you watch it.
Yeah, I mean, I've done a lot of interviews, and I was talking to a lot of film directors and filmmakers, but this is the first time that I interviewed someone and during the interview I completely understood the movie in a completely different way, that even though I loved it before the interview, I loved it even more after the interview, because of her insight and the way that she
mm-hmm.
and the answer she gave to some of my questions. So, but read the interview after you watch the movie, because we go into some spoiler territory.
Yeah, and also, just because I brought it up, I want to reemphasize, if you've never read Pauline Kael's review of Nashville, please do that. Because we'd love to hear what movies you've experienced this with, where you're just so excited by the filmmaking that you're just like, ooh, what's happening? Because it's like such a unique thrill at movies. It's not very often it happens. It happened with Parasite this year, I think, too. But it's pretty rare, I think, where you just feel like you don't know what you're in for at all, but you just trust, you just implicitly trust the person who's guiding you through the story.
Yeah, because the person is so bold and so
yeah.
sure of what they're doing.
Yeah. Yeah, there's one element, and we can wait to talk about this till afterward. There is one part of Atlantic that I don't really like, and I'm not really sure what the point was, but it's a minor complaint. And it involves a detective, I'll just say that. Because all these, like, crazy things are going on in the movie, so the law enforcement gets involved. So that thread of it, I have to say, I didn't love. But otherwise, I love the movie.
What else do we want to talk about? Do we want to talk about waves?
You know, Waves is one of these things that, like, I don't even know what to say about it other than to say, because I can't recommend it to anyone because people have such such stark reactions to this movie. And I loved it. But I've talked to so many people who did not like it. And it just, like, I can't seem to predict who its audience might be in terms of how people react to it.
Probably no one.
Oh, you didn't like it.
I liked some aspects of it, but I didn't love it. So this is Trey Edward Schultz, who did Krisha, who did It Comes Out at Night. This is his third movie. It's about this African-American family and their son, who's a star wrestler. And things happen in his life, and that's the first half of the movie. And you think this is the whole story, but then there's a major thing that happens halfway through. And you think, okay, it ended, but then it shifts. And it's the story of someone completely else. So it's very ambitious in its storytelling. Mm-hmm. I found it sonically staggering. Like, the effects and the music and just the sound of it, it was enveloping. And you're in this world that is just sound for most of the movie. And that, to me, is an accomplishment all of its own. And it's a great accomplishment. Not sure the writing was sharp. I think the actors were straining to do a lot of work with these characters that sometimes make no sense. It was very schematic, so it's two stories. And he was trying to so obviously hammer the links between the first story and the second story. Mm-hmm. And it was just like, we get it. You are making a connection. We're smart. Like, audiences are smart. You don't need to spell it out to me this way. I remember turning to Philip in the middle of the second story, and there's a pregnancy in the first story, and everything that happens in the first story is repeated in the second story. And then I was just so over it, and I turned to Philip and I said, if she gets pregnant, I'm leaving. Well, you know, spoiler, she did not. So the schematic scenes do not actually get that literal, but they get pretty close.
Yeah. I mean, that's what I'm talking about. People have these very sort of, and I think this is an accomplishment of itself. People have these very sort of passionate reactions to the movie, good and bad, which I think is an accomplishment for a filmmaker, because people can be jaded when they're watching things.
Oh, he's a great filmmaker. Like, he could do things. We've all seen Krisha. I just don't think he was successful this time. But you liked it, so why don't you tell us what you liked about it?
Well, I actually loved the bifurcated nature of it. I thought it was such a fascinating way to approach a story that has a lot of trauma in it, because, you know, if you've ever experienced something very traumatic, and, you know, most of us will or have already at some point in your life, you will or you already have, life, at least from my experience, life feels like before and after when you experience something very traumatic. And I'm talking about, like, true trauma, not just, like, you had a bad day, you know, or this thing didn't go your way. And I really, really do think, for those who've been through it, trauma divides your life in half. Mm-hmm. You were like, there's this person I was before this happened to me, and there's this person I am after this happens to me. And I thought that was such a bold way to tell the story. I wouldn't necessarily nominate this for best screenplay. I do agree that, you know, the writing, there are a couple of issues here and there, but conceptually, I thought it was very bold, and I actually loved the two-story way of telling the story. And I thought, I can see what you're talking about, actors straining, because it's very sort of, I don't want to say abrasive, but it's very sort of loud, emotional context. But I thought the acting was very strong, and Taylor Russell, especially, she has the movie's quietest performance. And to me, she was like revelatory. I cannot wait to see what she does next. I'd seen her in one thing, I think, before this. But hadn't really like clocked her. I just thought she was amazing.
Yeah, I agree on her. She was definitely the standout for me too. And maybe to what you were saying, because she's quiet against everyone else who's so loud. And the movie itself is so loud. And it's just, there's this quiet center and oasis in the middle of all these things that are happening. And probably that's why I responded to her the most. And it seems the Indisperis agrees, because they only nominated her out of everything else in the movie. That was the one nomination that Waves got from the Indisperis.
Yeah, and do you remember when this movie premiered at Telluride, all the pundits were like, it's going to be up for all the Oscars.
Yeah,
and this is why I'm always telling other pundits, I know this is so bitchy of me and so so bossy, but I'm always like, calm down, people, after the after first screenings of things. The same way I felt after 1917, when everyone's like, the greatest movie of all time. I'm always like, maybe don't tweet things while credits are rolling. Because
That was funny, because I was in the screening, because while those tweets were coming out, we were still in the screening and listening to Sam Mendes, and I'm looking at these tweets and I'm like, am I in an alternate reality? Is something happening that I'm not part of? Because did they all see the same movie I saw? It's a good movie. It's just not the best movie ever made.
Oh, 1917? Yeah. Yeah, but I mean, that's the thing. It's like, when you react to something, I just don't think it's smart in general to, like, not wait until credits are over before you decide how you felt about something. Just because, like, especially ambitious movies, they need a little bit of time to settle. But anyway, so people were, I remember at the time that the premiere to Telluride Waves, people were like, oh, you know, the farewell, now its Oscar campaign is toast, because like A24 would be crazy if they devoted any resources to the farewell with these reactions to Waves. But as we've discovered, Waves is very, very divisive, and a lot of people just don't like it at all, including places where you'd think it would be a natural fit, like the Indisperis.
Yeah. I mean, I think any awards hopes it has are dead, because if even the Indisperis cannot give you more than one nomination for Best Supporting Actor, like Actress, who else is going to nominate you, Waves? No one.
Right. So, you know, I feel a little bit sad about that, because I also think it's a really good movie. But on the other hand, like, it just goes, dovetails back into what I'm saying about people really should check their first impressions of things.
And also, Nathaniel, awards are not everything. So, you know, some people are going to find this movie, I don't know, 2 years down the road, when Trey Edward Schultz makes his next movie and it's going to be great, and people will be, well, let me go back and see what he did in 2019.
Yeah.
And then I think more people are going to love it then.
Yeah, yeah. But I just mean, awards exacerbate this problem of people having these wildly blurb horror sort of reactions to things, where it's like everything is all caps and everything is hyperbole. It's either the greatest thing that you've ever seen or it's absolute shit. And I was like, you know, most things are in between.
Yes. What did you think of the Spirit Awards? I keep trying to transition.
Sorry, I'm very passionate about discussing Waves, apparently. The Spirit Awards, you know, here's my thing with the Spirit Awards. I feel like I need a list of what's eligible every year to actually have an opinion. And because it's not the same as what's eligible elsewhere, because they have all these rules about budgets and all that, and a lot of those things we aren't privy to necessarily. And they moved the budget level up by a couple $1 million this time. So, I mean, I didn't know what they were shutting out necessarily. So I didn't really know how to react to it.
I mean, it seems they really loved Uncut Gems and the Willem Dafoe movie.
The Lighthouse.
The Lighthouse, yes.
Which, and it is interesting that The Lighthouse basically led the nominations but was not nominated for Best Feature.
Yeah, and there is A Hidden Life, only nominated for Best Feature.
Right.
I mean, I loved some things about it, like Mateusz Kunard's being nominated for Best Actor for The Mustang, which is a movie that came out at Sundance and then was released in March, and it's a good
and
movie.
And did well in theaters, by the way, but people seem to have forgotten about it.
He's so great in it. So this is, like, one nomination I was very happy to see. There are a couple of, like, those, you know, like, things like Give Me Liberty was this movie that I saw at BAM Cinema Fest in June, And it was startling, and I was just like, who is this director? And apparently The Indie Spirits agrees, because they nominated for several things, including Best Actor and Cinematography and Best Supporting Actress. And it is a good movie, but I don't even know if it was ever released, because movies that play at festivals, and this was at BAM Cinema Fest, are eligible, but does it even have a distributor? I don't know.
Right, yeah. See, that's the other thing. It's like really hard to know what's eligible for these particular awards. I liked that their director nominations were pretty bold, and that they didn't line up with their best features, which was fun.
That was so very fun. Just one. Uncut Gems.
Yeah. And but I was really happy to see Laureen Scafaria for Hustlers, because she does a great job of directing that movie. And I think we mentioned this on the Honey Boy podcast, but Alma Harrell's direction of that really elevates that movie.
So much. And this is like, if there was a lone director nom, that's it. Because the direction is so much more than the movie in Honey Boy.
Yeah. Yeah. There were things about this Spirit nominations I liked, and then there were other things that made, you know, very little sense to me. I don't think Marriage Story was not... Well, they took the Altman Award, which means they can't be nominated for individual acting awards, which is fine. You know, I totally understand that rule, because I always think it's stupid at SAG when they nominate every actor and then also nominate them for ensemble.
Yeah.
I do think it's like strange that to not have Marriage Story in, you know, so many different categories when it's up for Best Feature.
They were like, Noah Baumbach, sorry, dude. Yeah, no director for you. But the thing is with that, like, remember last year, Marriage Story, it's technically an indie, but it's not really. It stars big stars. It's a star director. It's a movie that obviously going to contend at all other awards. Like, last year they did that with Can You Ever Forgive Me and with BlacKkKlansman, where they gave them one nomination here and there, and did not actually contend in the major categories, but they ended up actually winning in The Spirits in the end. Richard E. Grant won, and Nicole Hall of Center won. So maybe that's what they're doing with Marriage Story this year.
Yeah, maybe. I do like that they're so idiosyncratic with their, you know, nominations and things.
Yeah.
But, Best Actress was, I thought, very surprising. Even though they had like six nominees, it was a very surprising lineup. You know, like ignoring people who have a lot of buzz and going with like Karen Allwell. I think Karen Allen's really good in Colwell, but I literally thought I was the only person who'd ever seen this movie.
I've never even heard of that movie at all until the day they announced the nominations.
It's like a tiny, tiny micro-budget indie. And I saw it at, Bentonville, I think. It's just tiny, tiny. Like, so it's one of these things where, you know, you think that the Spirit Awards are going to be about that. Because I remember when I was younger, the Spirit Awards were more like that.
Mm-hmm.
Where you would watch them and you would see categories and you wouldn't recognize like 20% of any given category or 40%. And I think that's really exciting about the Spirit Awards, but then they abandoned that for a long time, and now they're back to it, apparently.
And that's great, because
that's
remember
the only example.
They had those couple of years where like they were just the kind of like mini studio movies would win everything and get nominated for everything, and then it was like, what's the difference? So yeah, I think you said it too, but yeah, I like this new direction or back course correction.
Yeah. But wow, they sure did like Uncut Gems, which I have not seen, but you have. So
I love
that worth? Oh,
I
you
love
do.
It.
Okay.
It's up there. It's going to be in my top two, top three. It's so good, so amazing. And I will say this: I never thought I would think another actor did a better job than Antonio Banderas, but then came Adam Sandler, and I don't know. Maybe my vote goes to him now. No, he's so good. I love Antonio. Antonio, you do not have to worry. You will always be in my heart. But.
I don't know. I feel like I'm hearing blasphemy right now. I don't know.
But Adam Sandler is pretty great. Pretty great. And it's such a good movie. You've seen Good Time, right?
I have not. No, I'm not very well versed in the Safdie brothers, because every time, they have a movie and people get excited about it. Something, I don't know what it is. I'm not proud of this necessarily, but we all have our blind spots. Yeah. Every time I think, oh, I don't want to see that. Like see a trailer or like, there's just something about their oeuvre that has turned me off in concept form.
I so love Good Time, and I love Uncut Gems even more. It is so great. It's such a great time at the movies. Like, you would not expect this movie to be such a good time. It is so funny. Every moment of it has, like, this laugh-out joke, and it's just relentless and frenetic, and it goes and goes, and it's loud and obnoxious, but it's so good. Like, if it wins all the indie series it's nominated for, I'll be happy. It's that good.
Wow. Okay. I'll try to see it.
We got the screener. Just see it.
I can't keep track of screeners once they start arriving, because like I'm always waiting for one or two particular ones, and then they don't show up, and then I was like, oh. You know, there has not been 1 year, and I've been getting screeners for many years now, there has not been 1 year where I've had a screener for every movie that ended up a Best Picture nominee. Which is always really frustrating because they always plan to do these like deep dive things, comparing things. Mm-hmm. But then I can't because there's always one that's missing. You know, when one movie doesn't send out a screener or something.
Well, you do have Uncut Gems. I can guarantee that. So look at your pile. Get it out. Watch it. It's great.
But before we move on from Indie Spirits, I just have to complain once more about Best Supporting Male. Because I complain about category fraud all the time with the Oscars, but this is really crazy. They don't, I haven't seen Burning Cain, so I can't comment on Wendell Pierce, but I've heard
he's supporting.
Okay. But everyone else, to my mind, is a lead. Like literally the entire category.
I don't know. Jonathan Majors is pretty supporting in The Last Black Man in San Francisco. I don't think I saw that movie and thought of him as a lead at all. He is not the lead. The movie's not about him or his story. He's a side character, and even he might be in a lot of scenes, but he's silent for most of them. I just think of it as a supporting performance.
I just think of all four of those performances as leads, but that's me.
It is a little jarring to see both Noah Jupe and Shia LaBeouf in the same category. That always is like, so who's the lead?
It's Lucas Hedges, apparently, who has less screen time than either of them.
Yeah, that was a little jarring to me, too.
It's a father-son drama, and both the father and son are supporting somehow.
Yeah. Especially since, like, we talked about this in the Honey Boy thing. Nobody cares about Lucas Hedges. He's not the lead in anything. He's not the best. He's not the lead. He's nothing in that movie.
Yeah, he doesn't even have as much screen time as they do. The movie would be stronger if he wasn't in it, I think.
Yeah, just cut him out.
And not least because him and Noah Jupe look nothing alike, but
yeah, that was the jarring thing about that one. Yeah,
yeah, because like it's always difficult with age jumps in movies, but that was particularly difficult because it's like, how did this person, did they get plastic surgery, what happened? How did this person become that
I
person?
Mean, none of them look like each other. They do not look like either of them. They don't look like Shia. So it's just, but it's fine. Like, whatever, it's movies, it's not real life. We get it, Alma Harrell. It's fine.
Oh. Anyway.
So, do you want to talk about best cinematography? Since 1917 opened, it's basically, this is one where you're like, okay, sign, seal, delivered. Roger Deakins, number two. Go stand on the side, get your Oscar. We don't even need to talk about anybody else. You know, that's how I feel.
I know, but I think that's very sad when that happens because, it's wonderfully shot. And of course, the technical challenge is enormous. But I just think, you know, these craft categories are always undervalued. So I hate it when one movie is so dominant that people don't even care about the other ones. But I do think it's worth discussing what the other four, who deserves to be there, and, you know, what did you really respond to this year on cinematography?
And we can even discuss Deakins, because we just said he's going to win, but we haven't said why.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's, you know, that he would win even if it wasn't as gorgeously shot as it is, because the technical achievement is just so gobsmacking, you know, because it's all, well, it's not all one shot, but it looks like it's all one shot.
There are some very obvious cuts. I mean, it fades to black at one point. Spoiler, but so.
It does. I was like, well, there is one example for sure where there is an edit there. And there's other times where it goes behind buildings or whatever. You're like, oh, here's another edit. But
and that becomes like a thing, right? Because you're like, where did they cut? It becomes like an exercise, which is kind of why I want to see the movie again, because just forget about looking for the edits and just, you know, just get into the story.
But I will say there are things that happen in it that the fact that it's, even though it's not one movie that's all one shot, there are things that happen within it that are kind of jaw-dropping, because regardless of whether or not the whole movie is one shot, some of those individual shots within it go on for like a long time, and some things happen where you're like, how is this happening? Particularly the climax of the movie, which we heard him discuss how he shot afterwards, and it just sounded so complicated. I couldn't even wrap my brain around it.
And it's just, there are parts of it that are so stunning. You're just stunned by the beauty. Like when it turns to night and they're shooting in light, and it's just stunning. Like, you're stunned by just the composition, just how gorgeous it looks.
Yeah. And there's that great scene where they go in under the trenches and with the where they're shining their lights. Mm-hmm. It's very Deakins looking, you know. It's like, oh yeah, that's Deakins, because you've seen him do. He loves shadows against bright lights, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
which we've seen a lot of movies, Sicario, a bunch of other movies, Prisoners. You know,
it's nice when somebody like pays homage to themselves.
Right. I love that. Yeah. No, I love the cinematography in 1917. I'm just saying there are other people who did really, really great work this year.
Who do you like? Who's up for awards? So you have, besides Roger Deakins, you have Robert Richardson for Once Upon a Time in America, The Lighthouse, Joker, Little Women are your top five, and then right below is Ford v. Ferrari, The Irishman, and Parasite.
These are not my preferences. These are my predictions. I do think most of these movies are very well shot. The one movie that I think should probably have been in my predictions here, but I don't actually like the cinematography of, I just want to say this, is The Two Popes.
I don't understand why that movie is up for any awards at all. It's just down the middle, everything.
Yeah.
Acting, the two writing, popes is... directing, cinematography is just mediocre.
The cinematography, Cesar Chalon, is very busy. You know, there's like different types of film stocks. There's like a black and white sequence. It's constantly busy, just like the editing is constantly busy. And I found it distracting, and also kind of ugly, not in the same way that Knives Out is ugly, but, you know, they're doing some shots attempt to sort of put it in the context of the real world, like, because this is a true story and there is news footage of these things happening. So there are things that are shot like television, that aren't pleasant to look at, you know, like high def type of things. And then other things are pretty to look at. I just found it, the mishmash of tones, very, distracting in The Two Popes, but I do think it's the type of thing that might get nominated.
Mm. And what do you think of A Hidden Life? I mean, Terrence Malick is always all about cinematography, and his movies get nominated in that.
Yeah, I mean, I had heard of that cinematographer before, which is my only hesitation. Or not my only hesitation, because I also don't necessarily think the Oscar voters are going to watch A Hidden Life. Like, it doesn't seem to have the buzz of other... of the acclaimed Malick pictures, you know.
Mm-hmm. It looks gorgeous. It's just what you would expect a Malick movie to look like.
Yeah. And then The Irishman, like Rodrigo Prieto, I really love him as a cinematographer in general, but I don't really particularly love the cinematography of The Irishman. But I do think that that has a great shot because of all the buzz for the movie.
Yeah, I mean, it's just like, they're just going to... I think if The Irishman is the juggernaut that everybody thinks it is, that's like an easy just, yep, get him in.
Yeah. I will say the second time watching Parasite, I was like, wow, this cinematography is great. Which I hadn't... It isn't a movie that struck me the first time as being like a cinematography movie. Mm-hmm. But I was very impressed the second time with it.
A movie that I think might contend, although it has no buzz in any other category, it might contend in sound too, is Ad Astra. That movie looks gorgeous and it's beautiful, and maybe cinematographers will appreciate the job that it took to do that.
Well, Hoyt Van Hoytema, who shot that movie, is one of the greats, so that would be a pleasant surprise. One thing that I thought for sure was like a shoe-in that I don't see happening now was, before we saw the movie, was John Toll for Harriet, because he used to be an Oscar favorite.
Mm-hmm.
And there's so much outdoor stuff that I thought, oh, they're going to love that.
Mm-hmm.
But then people don't just aren't enthused with the movie.
Yeah. I mean, the accomplishment here to me in this category, besides Deakins, is The Lighthouse. Like, that movie is just like, it's about the cinematography.
Yeah.
If there was
I don't even like that movie, but I love the cinematography.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I will say that about Joker, too. I feel the same way about Joker. Like, I understand the craft elements of Joker are very good. I just don't like the movie.
Yeah, it looks good. Another movie that I just saw, and maybe we can discuss it in a future episode, is Queen and Slim. And the best thing about that movie is the way it looks. It's not just the cinematography, but just... The way the actors posed, costumes, like the frame, you know this is a video, a music video director, because every frame looks beautiful. And of course, a big part of that is the cinematography. I don't know that this movie has any awards buzz at all, but it's definitely worth considering in cinematography.
Well, didn't that cinematographer shoot Lemonade or something?
Yes. Yep.
Yeah. And the one we haven't mentioned that I think is the only other one that's a complete lock is Once Upon a Time in Hollywood for cinematography.
Yeah.
And I go hot and cold on Robert Richardson. Sometimes I just do not understand why people are excited. Like, I did not think he deserved the nomination for Django Unchained, for example. But I thought his work on Once Upon a Time in Hollywood was one of his very best work that he'd ever done.
Yeah, I mean, that movie has all those tracking shots, and tracking shots are always, sometimes they're kind of obvious, like, of course you'd go to a tracking shot here, okay, but they really work in Once Upon a Time.
Yeah.
They work so well, and you're just like, and it's one of those things where, like, as they're tracking, things look different, and the light changes, and it's such a good job. Like,
it's a very beautifully shot movie.
Yeah.
I could see Ford v. Ferrari happening. Which most people don't seem to think could happen, but I could see it happening.
I mean, that movie is a big hit, so
yeah.
It's a big hit with Oscar. Could get in.
So it'll be interesting, but I think one of the reasons that Roger Deakins emerged so suddenly as like a lock to win, even before nominations, which is, you know, less common than people think it is, like, oh, they're going to win for sure,
mm-hmm.
Is that it hasn't, even though a lot of these movies are beautifully shot, it really hasn't been a movie where cinematography has become a focus. Whereas, you know, there are some years where everyone's like, oh my God, there's so much great cinematography out there this year. But this year doesn't feel like that to me. I don't know about to you.
I mean, besides The Lighthouse, there is not a movie that really stands out for its cinematography except 1917. And 1917 is about the cinematography. It's so just obviously the thing that's the takeaway. And so it is going to be the takeaway.
Yeah. It's kind of hilarious that Roger Deakins had to wait decades to win, and now he's just going to win another one. Right away.
I mean, that happens all the time, right?
I mean,
it just happened for Lubezki.
Yeah. Oh, so a lot of... We're really getting down to the wire. It is, as we speak, it is December.
Yeah.
How did that happen?
No idea.
You.
Yes, it's... We're recording on December 1st. I have no idea. I had a panic last night when I'm like, oh my God, it's December. But it is.
Yeah. So I was going to have watched, you know, a certain in order to not get too far behind every year, you know, I keep lists of everything I see, and I like to be at a certain number because I know, like, I tend to have to see this many movies a year in order to have, like, valid opinions of this and that, you know, and I'm, like, behind, and I'm, like, struggling. And it's December. I'm like, no!
It is. And tomorrow, maybe while you're listening to this, you already know who won the Gotham Awards.
All right. Yeah, that's coming up very quick. BIFA is very quick, too.
Yeah. New York and NBR are also this week, so next week is the big awards week. New York critics.
Unfortunately, it's exciting, but unfortunately, this is also the time of year where it suddenly gets, you have to give up all your favorites that you're, long shots that you're rooting for, because everything starts to narrow down very quickly, which is always a little sad.
That's true, yeah.
Just because then you end up, you know, the groupthink happens before anybody has a chance to fight against it. Especially this year, like, I think we're going to have more, I'm expecting there's going to be more, less variation this year because everybody's voting at the same time.
That's true. So tell us in the comments who is the one hope you don't want to give up on yet, even though it might be time to. And I think this is all we have this week.
You say that like we haven't talked about a lot.
We have.
And so we will be back next week. Next week will be a big awards week, as we just said, so we'll have a lot to discuss, and we'll probably focus mostly on the awards race next week. So if you have any questions for us, we'd love to answer those as well. And I'll put up a thing for your questions next week. It'll be a very busy week at the blog, so stay tuned. I hope you visit us every day, and we'll talk to you next week.